Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. One of my biggest fears is being kidnapped. The idea of completely disappearing from the lives of my friends and family terrifies me. So when I found out that a young woman went missing in my hometown of Plano, Texas, I was scared. It was like I was seeing my biggest fear play out in the life of someone else. And when I found out later that her biggest fear was being kidnapped, my heart sank. I've been following this case ever since her disappearance was announced in September of 2014. Now that I have a platform, I want to use it in the hopes that someone can help us find Christina. Okay, on to the show. August 29th, 2014, Plano, Texas. 23-year-old Christina Morris is ready for a night out with her old high school friends. After moving more than an hour away to Fort Worth, Texas with her boyfriend, Hunter Foster, she was ready to just relax. She made plans to meet up with her friend, Paulina Petrosky, around 9 p.m. As they hit up local bars, Christina must have realized how much she missed this time with her friends. When she would normally call it a night because of work early the next morning, she opted to stay out later than usual and spend the night at Paulina's. This party had to continue, so they opted to head to Paulina's house, which was near the shops at Legacy. The shopping center is a mixed-use site with a variety of upscale restaurants, apartments, and retail stores. It's a hot spot of activity, with thousands of people visiting daily for the shopping and nightly for the bar scene. At around 11:30 a.m., Christina parks her silver Toyota Celica in the garage inside the shops. Paulina had invited mutual friends Sabrina Boss, Steven Nickerson, and an acquaintance, Enrique Orochi, to hit the local bars. Nearly an hour later, her ID card is scanned at the Scruffy Duffy's bar, and at 12:34 a.m., she buys herself a drink. Christina wasn't much of a drinker due to suffering from migraines. Her friends would later recall that on the particular evening of August 29th, she did not drink heavily. Sabrina, Paulina, and Enrique decided to hit up the local Whataburger while Christina and Steve return to the apartment. She engages in a text argument with her boyfriend Hunter and opts to head home as opposed to spending the night as she had planned. Steven recalled that Christina was upset after the text exchange and told him that she was going to return to Fort Worth that night. He attempted to convince her to stay, but she was determined to return home. When the three returned to the apartment, things began to wind down. Christina told Paulina that she would be going home, and she began to cry about her fight with Hunter. Paulina tried to console her, but she was adamant about returning back to Fort Worth that night. It's 3:30 a.m. when Christina announces that she will be leaving. Enrique, who is sitting nearby on the couch, announces that he will be leaving too. Christina must have been relieved to have had somebody to walk with. Friends and family would state that she hated walking alone at night and would never do so without an escort. This evening, Enrique was hers. Christina and Enrique begin their 20-minute walk back to the parking garage. 13 minutes into their walk, she calls her friend Steve Nickerson to say that she hasn't made it to her car yet. He doesn't notice anything strange in her voice, nothing to give him a sign that something was wrong. If something was wrong, he would have come to her as fast as he could. She said she would text him when she made it to her car. She was attempting to call Hunter, but received no response from him. In total, she would call him over a dozen times, with the calls going unanswered. Whatever Hunter was doing in Dallas, it was more important than his argument with Christina. Between 3:50 and 3:55 a.m., she would use Enrique's phone to call or text Hunter. The last time she uses his phone is when they are seen walking into the parking garage. Just 3 minutes later, his car would be seen exiting the garage. Christina's vehicle remained there. This was the last time she was seen alive, and the last person she was seen by was Enrique Orochi. The following is a timeline of the events as we know them now. 4:08 a.m. Enrique continues driving along Highway 121. 4:47 and 4:56 a.m., Christina and Enrique's cell phones ping the cell tower at 5800 Granite Parkway, which is north of the shops at Legacy. There is no account of where Enrique is until 5:32 a.m., when his cell phone pings the cell tower on the 1500 block of Bethany Drive in Allen, Texas. Christina's phone makes no other pings. Around 10:15 a.m. the next day, Enrique arrives at the Kroger grocery store in Allen to pump gas. Surveillance video captures him pumping gas, inspecting his trunk and driver's side. He then grabs a squeegee and begins wiping down the passenger side door and back of the vehicle near the trunk. It is surprising that he is spending so much time looking over his vehicle and presumably cleaning it when he's already 3 hours late to work. He finishes at the gas station and arrives to work 45 minutes later. He walks in with a small limp and has scratches and bite marks that are visible on his arm. We know this because Enrique shared with his coworkers that his ribs had been hurt from a fight at the bar the night before. Steven attempted to call Christina, but received no answer. He had been waiting for her text that she had made it safely to her car, but it never came. The morning got away from him, and he figured she made it home. No one would hear from Christina, and it wouldn't be until that following Tuesday that her mother, Johnny McElroy, would be contacted. Christina's best friend, Megan Fishman, was contacted by Christina's boss, who noticed that she had not shown up to work the past 4 days. She inquired about her whereabouts, because it was not like her to miss work. Christina was reliable and dependable. Anyone who knew her would tell you this was fact. Megan agreed that this was odd behavior from Christina, and immediately contacted Christina's mother, Johnny. Johnny was living in Tulsa, Oklahoma at the time, and was at work when she received the message from Megan. The round of phone calls were made, and no one had heard from Christina. Johnny and Christina's stepmother, Anna Morris, began to contact friends, asking if they had seen her. Johnny knew that something bad had happened. This was not like her daughter. All of the friends who were present that evening shared with her family that she had last been seen around 3:30 a.m. with Enrique Orochi. Her father, Mark Morris, called Plano 911 to report her missing. The police arrived to the parking garage and found her car, but her father said it appeared as if she had never gotten in the car. They would later confirm, through surveillance video, that the car never left the parking garage that night. Anna contacted Enrique to ask about the last time he saw Christina. She had gotten his name from the friends who were with them that night. He said they only walked to the garage and went in separate directions to their respective cars. They had parked quite a distance from each other, he said. This struck Anna as odd because Christina would have most likely requested that he walk her all the way to her car. She hated walking alone in the dark. Anna then reached out to Hunter to ask if he had heard from her. He shared that Christina was angry with him that evening for saying that he wanted to kick her ex-boyfriend's ass. She was upset since she had broken up with him over a year ago and didn't understand why Hunter was acting this way. He told Anna that he lost his phone that evening and never knew she was calling him. He had not heard from her since the 30th. He figured she was upset and decided not to come back home, and maybe went to go visit her mom in Oklahoma. He didn't attempt to reach out to her to see if she was okay. He logged onto her Facebook page on September 3rd, 2014, and posted the following. This is Hunter Foster, Christina's boyfriend. She went out with friends to the Shops of Legacy. She has been missing for 4 days. Her car has been found at the Shops of Legacy, but not her. I'm worried sick and will do anything to get any information on the last time anyone has seen her or talked to her. Please help and pray that she is okay. Police are involved and we are going to find her and whoever has taken her or whoever she is with. Any information would be a blessing. Please pray for her and her family. A friend replied to the post asking, "Is this a real post?" To which Hunter replied, "Yes, this is a real post. And yes, we will find her. Thank you to all who repost this and share this to others. Please just keep praying she is okay. And again, any info about her at all would be the greatest news for her family and me as well. She is very loved by so many. Like I said, she will be found. Just please keep praying for her. Plano police continued their investigation into the disappearance of Christina Morris. They obtained surveillance video from the shops at Legacy, and it showed that Enrique and Christina had walked towards the parking garage together. The video was only 6 seconds long, which left them with more questions than answers. They remained mum on the progress of the investigation. Her family was understandably frustrated, but refocused their efforts and energy on getting the word out that Christina was missing. Weeks would pass, and the family grew increasingly worried. They know for her to be gone this long would mean that something happened to her, and it wasn't anything good. She would have called. Even if she had gotten into a fight and needed to get away, she would have told someone. She would never just up and leave. She was very close to her mother, father, stepmother, and siblings. Plus, she had a dog named Madden, who she was devoted to. Red flags were popping up everywhere. Texas Sequisearch would volunteer in the search for Christina, along with friends, family, and members in the community. Flyers would be distributed, and a billboard would even go up requesting information on her disappearance. Crime Stoppers offered a reward, and an anonymous donor eventually increased it to about $20,000. They would search rural areas within Collin County and meet weekly to discuss which areas to hit next. Social media accounts were created, and Team Christina was in full force. They wanted to find their daughter, and they needed all the help they could get. Meanwhile, authorities questioned friends who were with Christina that night, and they all shared the events of that evening. They each state that she didn't drink heavily and that Enrique was the last person to see her alive. One person, Sabrina Boss, stated that Enrique was angry when he left because she told him to move away from her when they were seated on the couch. This told Enrique that she was not interested in him. Plus, he had a girlfriend at the time. Other friends stated that they did not notice anything odd or out of the ordinary with Christina or Enrique as they left the apartment. When they questioned Enrique, they noticed small inconsistencies in his story and request his consent to search his vehicle. He agrees, and his car is processed. On September 6, 2014, he is questioned about the cuts and bruises to his arms. He states that he was rotating the tires on his Camaro when a tire fell on his arm. He got frustrated and punched the passenger side of the vehicle, denting it. Friends who were with him that evening would dispute that they saw any bruises or cuts on his arm. They take photographs of his hands and arms and record it as evidence. They also search his trash and find cleaning rags, towels, and empty cleaning bottles. They seem to be recently purchased. What was Enrique cleaning up? Things were beginning to quickly go south for Enrique. On September 15, 2014, his regional manager at the Sprint store contacted the Wiley Police Department to file a theft report. He had stolen a gold Samsung Galaxy S5 phone and activated it on his personal account. The day of the activation was listed as August 25, 2014. He was arrested that same day and was released on bond on September 22, 2014. The phone had been wiped by Enrique at some point. They conduct another trash pull a couple days later and find more cleaning supplies and a note written in Spanish listing the following: black shirt, text from the 29th through today's date, bank bills, and cellular bills. They also contact Kroger to obtain the security from the day Enrique visited and curiously washed different parts of his vehicle. This triggers them to request a search warrant on his car. It was clear he was hiding something and was very interested in erasing anything that tied him to Christina. Christina's family continues to contact Enrique, though he refuses to return their calls. This frustrates them, and they comment about their frustrations on social media and to the local news outlets. On November 4th, 2014, Enrique responds with an interview of his own. I'll play that for you now.
Police documents are revealing new information about the man who police questioned after the disappearance of a young woman in Plano. Enrique Arochi spoke to Fox 4 about what police call false statements he's made that police say have hurt their investigation and attempts to find Christina Morris. Fox 4's Dion Anglin has more. And Dion, we should, I guess, start out that police do not say he is a suspect at this point.
Yeah, that's right. Not a suspect. Police say he is a witness. Now, the document released on Tuesday, a search warrant affidavit, gives more insight as to why police wanted a close look at Enrique Arroche's car.
I just want to say that I'm innocent. I didn't do anything to Christina Morris.
Enrique Arroche spoke to Fox 4 about the search warrant affidavit that points out he made false statements to police, hindering efforts to find Christina Morris, who vanished more than 2 months ago. He was seen leaving a party, walking with Morris in the parking garage at Shops of Legacy in Plano, but at first denied to police parking there.
It wasn't that I falsified anything. It's just I forgot where I parked my car. I'm a really distracted guy. I don't have a sense of direction.
More discrepancies. Arroche told police he didn't talk to Morris all that night. The affidavit states Arroche's cell phone records showing text messages and a phone call were made from his cell phone to Morris's boyfriend.
I didn't even remember that I let her borrow my phone to call her boyfriend. And the detectives told me that I did, and I showed them. They were like, well, can we see your phone? And I showed them my phone.
Fox 4 confirmed Arroche was recently arrested by Wiley police on the charge embezzlement stemming from the theft of a Samsung phone from the Sprint store where he worked.
I did borrow a Sprint phone from my company because I was a manager. I thought I could make those kind of decisions, and I didn't have a phone at the time, and I needed to stay in touch with my store.
The affidavit states investigators noticed what appeared to be fresh damage to the front right fender of his Camaro and bruising to his right forearm and abrasions to his right hand.
And one of the rims fell on my arm, and I got really pissed because I got hurt, and I wanted to hurt something, so I hurt my car. I punched it twice.
Police say the explanation is inconsistent with the car's damage. And further, his reaction to what a co-worker said about how he looked the day after Morris's disappearance.
He's just an employee. I didn't tell him anything. I don't know where he got that. I got in a fight, which I never did.
Now, Plano police have not made public the findings from searching Arroche's car. They point out tests to analyze some of the contents are still pending.
A month after this interview, police would receive the forensic report from the swabs they took from his car. The results would confirm that Christina Morris's DNA was found in his trunk, along with the DNA profile of an unknown male. With this evidence in hand, they issue an arrest warrant for Enrique on December 13, 2014. And at 7:50 a.m., he is arrested for the aggravated kidnapping of Christina Morris. He is arraigned a day later. It wouldn't be until March of 2015 when a grand jury would indict him on the charge of aggravated kidnapping for Christina Morris and child sexual assault for a 6-month sexual relationship he had with a 16-year-old girl. According to the grand jury indictment, Enrique was accused of intentionally or knowingly abducting Christina Morris by restricting the movements of said Christina Morris without her consent so as to interfere substantially with her liberty by moving her from one place to another or confining her with the intent to prevent her liberation by secreting or holding her in a place where she was not likely to be found and that he acted with the intent to violate or abuse sexually Christina Morris and terrorize Christina Morris. His bond was set at $1 million. Christina's mother responded to NBC DFW's request for comment on the indictment stating, "I hope he would do the right thing and end the pain and suffering he not only put his family through, but us. This is a new beginning. It shows a milestone of justice soon to be served." Enrique's attorney would release a statement on his indictment stating, Enrique denies the allegations in the indictment and will enter a not guilty plea. Grand jury proceedings are controlled by the prosecution and are closed to the public. We, therefore, do not know what the grand jury considered. Now that the charge has been indicted, the law requires the prosecution to disclose certain information to the defense. We will test the prosecution's claims and present Enrique's defense to a jury. Enrique asked to receive only that to which we are entitled, a fair trial. His inconsistencies in his answers to police and finding Christina's DNA in his trunk are what ultimately sealed the charge for him. Hunter Foster was eliminated as a suspect when his alibi checked out. Despite the looming trial, the search for Christina continued. Team Christina, for a time, held silent protests outside of Enrique's home, holding signs asking for answers. Once he was arrested and taken to the Collin County Jail, they stood out there when his visitors walked by, imploring them to ask Enrique for answers. His trial began on September 7, 2016. The prosecution would begin their opening statements asking jurors to take into consideration the surveillance video, which shows Christina and Enrique walking towards the parking garage together, and the video of him washing his car at the Kroger gas station. They pressed hard on the fact that her DNA was found in the trunk of his car, and that the cell phone tower pings show that they were together after leaving the apartment. Finally, they concluded that Enrique premeditated her kidnapping after his advances were rebuffed by Sabrina Boss. When he stated he was leaving, it was with the intent to sexually assault Christina. The defense would attempt to shift focus to Hunter Foster, stating that the text exchange between them was heated and emotional, and that co-workers would confirm their fighting had intensified more than usual, and it seemed to focus on Hunter's drug dealing. They would counter that the DNA was transferred by a crime scene technician who took a DNA sample from a soda can found in Christina's car and inadvertently placed it in Enrique's trunk when processing it for evidence. As the trial continued, prosecutors theorized that Enrique had convinced Christina to get into his vehicle, which she did so willingly. At some point, Enrique went the opposite way he was supposed to, and this caused a fight between him and Christina. This incensed Enrique, and at some point he assaulted her out of the car, disposed of her at some point, and attempted to hide the evidence. The trial also highlighted some odd things about Enrique. He had a steady girlfriend at the time, but as we know, rapists can have steady relationships but like the thrill that comes when they rape and assault someone. He told many different people different things about the injuries to his hands and that he and Christina went their separate ways. However, the DNA and cell phone clearly dispute this. They found deviant pornography on his phone, but did not elaborate on what exactly was deviant about it. Further, Enrique even shared with his family that prior to his trial, spending time in jail was like a mini vacation, and that the police had nothing on him. To me, this shows clearly that he is overtly confident. He reminds me of Paul Bernardo, really. The narcissist who believes he's untouchable. But as we all know, it didn't end well for Paul. The prosecution rested, and the defense began with the aforementioned theories that Hunter was more of a viable suspect than Enrique. I want to play their closing arguments so that you can get a full picture of what exactly their theories were.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, where is Christina Morris? We don't know. 2 weeks ago, when we started this journey, this trial, Mr. Fortenberry got up here in an opening statement and said, we don't know. But we're not required to show you or prove to you where she is. We're not required to prove to you what his motive was in doing this to Christina. We are required to show you who kidnapped Christina Morris in the early morning hours of August 30th, 2014. And the evidence in this case points to one man and one man only, Enrique Arochi. You heard a lot of evidence in the 2 weeks that you were here, most of it put on by the state. It's our burden of proof. We welcome that burden. But we put all that evidence on to show you the extensive investigation, the stellar investigation by the officers from the Plano Police Department. And it truly was. I mean, it truly took nearly the whole department. Everybody had a part. Everybody did something. No stone left unturned. No tip left not investigated. And why? Because they are confident in their case. They're confident they've got the right guy, Enrique Arochi. And so when you hear all this evidence, you look at it and you say, well, why did I hear all this? Because any possibility that it's anybody else just simply isn't there. So when we talked 2 weeks ago about the elements of aggravated kidnapping, Mr. Fortenberry talked to you about what you thought, maybe coming in prior to jury service, what you thought maybe an aggravated kidnapping would be. We think it's someone being grabbed and pulled away, and you all found out it could be something very different. It could be something like his example about you tell someone under false pretenses, hey, we'll do this, and then you take them, we'll go to the football game. We're going to watch a game at the bar, and then I'm taking you to the Cowboys game, but I'm not a Cowboys fan, and I don't want to go. But if you get me in there by false pretenses or by force or intimidation, that's without consent. And so when he gave you that example, it's to show you that kidnapping is more than what everybody thinks it is. It doesn't work in this arena every day. And you heard from all the officers that testified about their theory of the case. And their theory was that Christina got into his car voluntarily. What did he tell her? What was the premise? We don't know, but we're not required to show you that. But she got into his car voluntarily because we know that only 2 minutes passed from the time we see them walking into the parking deck until the time we see the car going out. But when you go back there and you decide this case, remember, the only thing the state has to prove are what's in these instructions. And remember what Mr. Fortenberry told you all in Vordire, that there's three different ways that the state has alleged that he's committed aggravated kidnapping: the intent to commit bodily injury, the intent to abuse sexually, or the intent to terrorize. Now, it's with the intent. It doesn't have to show that it actually happened, but that was his intent. Okay? And so some of you can think, yes, bodily injury based on the evidence that I heard. And some of you can think to abuse sexually, intent to abuse sexually. And some of you can think that it was to terrorize, the intent to terrorize. So all of you don't have to agree it was one of those three things, but all of you have to agree it was one, whether it be the first, second, or third. So some of you may have different ideas or how you interpreted the evidence. So all 12 of you don't have to think it's one, all the same one. It could be a combination of that, as long as you all agree. The other thing I'd like to talk about is venue. Because there was talk, and Mr. Gore asked a lot of the witnesses about, well, Denton County is about 5 miles from the shops at Legacy. How do you know it didn't happen there? And the judge instructed you on venue and what venue is, that if the crime starts in the county, it finishes in another county, we've proven venue. But that's just another rabbit trail that the defense wants to lead you down. What do we know in this case? We know a lot about Christina. And you wonder maybe why all those people were put on to talk about Christina. It's because Christina isn't here to speak for herself. And so all of you needed to know a little bit about Christina. What do we know about her? She had family and friends that loved her dearly. A lot of her friends testified she was the light in the room. She was fun. She was outgoing. She had a good job. She was going to get a promotion at work. All those good things about her. She was someone who was afraid of the dark. She wouldn't walk anywhere alone, and she certainly wouldn't get into the trunk of a car. And those are the things you needed to know about her, to know that this would be out of character for her to be in the trunk of his vehicle. But the one thing Christina didn't do, she didn't pick the right guy, Hunter Foster. And at 23, maybe you don't know yet, you know, that the bad guys aren't the ones you want to end up with, but Hunter Foster is who he is. He's a drug dealer. And they want so badly for you to believe that Hunter Foster was behind Christina's disappearance. And that's ridiculous. And there's absolutely zero evidence to support that. And how do you know that? Well, we know from Hunter Foster's toll records that, yes, he was in Plano. He came up about 10:30, 11 that night, the 29th. And then the toll records show he's turned around and he's gone back down the tollway, back down to Dallas. And how else do we know that, in spite of their cell phone expert? Because his cell phone is pinging off the tower in Plano, but when he's back in Dallas, it's pinging off the towers in Dallas. So they want you to believe Hunter Foster is involved. He got immunity. He got this. He's responsible. In order to believe that, you would have to ignore every other piece of evidence presented to you in this court today. And there simply isn't any evidence that supports that Hunter Foster had anything to do with Christina's disappearance. But perhaps what's telling and what started this is, remember the testimony of Anna Morris, Christina's mom. Anna said she called Enrique Arochi after his four-day head start ahead of the police. And she had that parent's intuition because she was asking him questions and knew he wasn't giving her the truth. And she felt, she just knew something was wrong. And she said to him, we're calling the police, expect a call. And when he told Anna Morris, I don't know what happened to her, we went our separate ways, that was the first thread in the web of lies he started spinning with respect to the disappearance of Christina Morris. And when you look at all the evidence, it leads you to one conclusion, and one conclusion only. And Enrique Arochi is responsible for Christina Morris's kidnapping. He's guilty, and find him guilty for that reason.
Your Honor, would you please
thank you.
Thank you, yes, sir. Judge, can I get a time check before Mr. Court begins?
36 minutes, 35 seconds.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I've been told by people I admire and respect that I have a face for radio, so you can imagine how excited I am right now. But it's not my purpose right now to try to just completely persuade you my way. I would love to do that. In my experience, though, you've got a good understanding of the facts, a command of the issues. And so if I may be of any service to you right now, it would be to walk through for you some of the important aspects of the law and the evidence that was brought forward in this trial that may be helpful for you in your deliberations. And you can see I've got a little PowerPoint, third time I've ever done it now. It's becoming quite a habit, but at the beginning of this entire process in jury selection, I told you the only thing that matters in a criminal case is, can the prosecution prove the words in the indictment? And the drill sergeant has given you instructions now that no one's at liberty to reject them. I think you've seen that I was shut down a few times by the drill sergeant and didn't like it, but that's the way it is. Same for you now. You have to do what he says. So I'd like to begin by talking about this concept. Has the state's evidence proven the words in the indictment beyond a reasonable doubt? Allow me to say something at the beginning. There's not a person in this courtroom that doesn't have a broken heart for the Morris family. Christina is missing. It's unimaginable. Hey, but you'll see no consideration or ability to take that into your deliberations. This is a difficult process, and you are called to charge a hill, fix the bayonets, and see if the state's evidence can do what they said it could. So we discussed if you hear all the evidence and you're saying to yourself that you simply don't know if anything happened, if that's where you find yourself saying, look, I don't know, even if you think something happened, I don't know what, the verdict is not guilty. A question to ask yourself is, did the prosecution keep their promises to you? In opening statement, Mr. Fortenberry wrote some big checks, very specific about exactly what he was going to tell you happened in this case, about when consent is given and when it's allegedly withdrawn and all kinds of stuff. So ask yourself, has the prosecution delivered on their promises? So you've heard several different competing theories in this case from several different witnesses, and I want to go over that with you. And the importance and relevance of that, I think, will come through. But the first theory that the prosecution advances is that if something happened, it all occurred in the garage. That's not at all what Mr. Fortenberry said in his opening statement. He told you that nothing happened in the garage. He tells you it was 1 minute. Ms. King now says it was 2 minutes. You know they're walking in at 3:55 and the car's leaving at 3:58. So 3 minutes in there. But one thing that they've done for you in their opening statement is told you this first theory's has no legs. The second theory that you've also heard witnesses sponsor is this idea that Christina wants to go somewhere or do something with Enrique. She voluntarily gives consent, but then later on something happens and changes and she withdraws the consent. So you can see here the prosecution is basically admitting with these different theories they don't know. Even if you think something happened, they can't give you any explanation. So let's take a look at these different theories. Under the first theory, again, if something happened, it's in the garage. And to support that theory, they want to bring you particular pieces of evidence. So if to go with this theory, they want you to think that she's okay to drive, right? Because if she's okay to drive, she would have gotten in her car and driven, but for something going on in the garage. You remember all the questions of all the witnesses and the receipts? You know, who had the least amount to drink? Did you all think she was okay? Stephen Nickerson saying, we were there at Paulina's house late in the night. I thought she was fine to drive. Remember Detective Benzik analyzing some video footage and telling you her gait appeared normal? What is all this an effort to do? First theory required them. They wanted to prove she's okay to drive. Another big feature of it is under the theory number one, they want there to be damage to the Camaro when it's seen leaving the garage. Why? They want to argue to you that there's an event happening in the garage that causes damage. How else do you know that under they wanted theory number one at some point? They go to the garage and they spray this blue star. They're looking for blood evidence. Of course, they don't find any, but this is how you know this was their theory. So the second theory, she wants to go somewhere with him, she's voluntarily consenting. And for that theory, the type of evidence that they want to prove is that she was not okay to drive. You heard Detective Benzik say he thinks that she knows herself. Now, I don't know from what that is derived, but he is willing to express that opinion to you, unsupported by any evidence. But in this theory, they want her to need a ride, you see? And in this theory, they want to say to you that there's no damage to the Camaro when it's leaving the garage. Why? To argue to you damage occurs sometime later. So what kind of evidence did you have in support of this first theory? Detective Stamm, at a pretrial hearing in January of 2015, swore to the judge across the hall the most probable thing was that the alleged offense happened in the garage. So see, there you go. She's sponsoring theory number one, which Mr. Fortenberry completely repudiated and said is impossible in his opening statement. She also said, Detective Stamm, in her sworn testimony in January 2015, that when the Camaro leaves the garage...
Objection or facts outside the evidence. Okay. We ask that Mr. Gordon remove that from his slide.
Take it down, Mr. Gordon.
Okay, so you can imagine... can imagine my surprise when the prosecution stands up an opening statement and tells you what they told you. Because I'm envisioning a time or a case where I'm going to defend theory number one, right? You're saying that something happened in the garage. Okay, I'm ready. I've consulted experts, witnesses, and my own investigation. I'm ready. So under this theory, this is the first time anybody's suggesting that Christina wants to hang out with Enrique and that there's this consent being withdrawn. They can't tell you where or when or why. So this alternate theory is being developed without any new evidence. And that's the point I was asking. I know I wore you out sometimes with these witnesses, and I covered the same ground over and over again, but this is why. I just want to know what you're saying happened, please, so I can defend him, please. So zero evidence, but they go all in on it, don't they? And so there I am. There I am, Lucy in the football. So let's keep looking at the first theory. Lieutenant Wise testified the first day of trial. All right, he supervises Detectives Busby and Sam, and he said that he helped them develop this theory, and his sworn testimony to you was, the offense was complete when the Camaro exits the garage. So Lieutenant Wise, anyway, is telling you something different than the prosecutor's telling you. Lieutenant Wise also tells you that the police's theory has not changed over the course of the investigation. Clearly, it's changed at some point. So it appears that, and there are several other witnesses we're going to get to, it doesn't seem like all the detectives and officers are on the same page with the DA's office. Detective Epperson, 35 years law enforcement, 33 of those with Plano. I ask you, you want to make sure you don't have multiple competing theories out there, right? Answer, yes, right. Question, you wouldn't come to a jury with different theories because you're inviting them to say, if you don't know, how can I, the juror, know? And his answer, yes. Detective Spielman, over 20 years at Plano. Similar questions, similar answers. You do not want to change your theory. Detective Spielman understands this concept as if the police don't know, how can you know? They don't have any right, the prosecutors, to ask you to fill in the blanks, to do their job for them, or to guess. There needs to be a unified theory, and this is it. And it's against what the court is telling you to do to try to help them along or fill in the blanks. That's their job. So I've mentioned this, the surprise. I'm not asking you to feel sorry for me. I'm hoping that you will see that when we have a situation where the people pointing their finger at you can't decide, that's a problem. Lieutenant Wise continues to testify. He believes all the police witnesses will agree on where and when the alleged offense occurred. If the police pick a new theory or a new horse, would that concern you, Lieutenant Wise? Yes, that would concern me. Lieutenant Wise understands that if the police and prosecutors can't get on the same page and agree, they don't have any right to come to you and make you do it, beyond a reasonable doubt at that. So let's cover, as we look at the events that evening, because you've heard the prosecutor say, you know, they're going to try to show you that he has formed an intent in his mind. It's his specific desire to violate or abuse sexually, to cause bodily injury, and to terrorize. So let's look at the evidence about how Enrique was that night. What was going on? Every single witness who was out with that group at the Shops at Legacy, they all swore to you that from the beginning of the evening until they leave, he's polite, he's friendly, happy, sociable, he's having a good time, no one noticed anything odd or unusual. He wasn't threatening. He wasn't aggressive. And what did Stephen Nickerson tell you? If he had half of 1% of a concern, he wouldn't have allowed it. He would have objected and said, no, don't go walking with him. He's acting crazy. So, but it's from this evidence that they're now asking you to decide that this individual who has been described that evening as acting like a gentleman, there's not been any issues, that it's some unknown place and time, they can't tell you, they just can't, but they're saying somewhere, somehow, at some time, we know that in spite of all this evidence about how he's acting, he forms an intention to do these things. Well, what's the evidence? What did they try to wheel out here to make you think that he has an intention to violate or abuse someone sexually? Well, you heard Detective Stam or Busby yesterday say that you can see Enrique walking to the exit of the garage. They've parked there. The group's getting there, and there's a group of people walking. And Enrique comes up and puts his arm around Sabrina. And the next screenshot we see, 30 seconds later or so, his arm's not there anymore. And from that, they come to you, and they say, that is proof beyond a reasonable doubt of an intention to commit sexual assault. The other thing that I think you might hear is, well, Sabrina and Enrique, they're talking on the couch there. Sabrina says, I want to go to sleep. And Enrique says, okay. And she says, well, I want to be on the couch. And he says, no. So she gets in bed with Paulina, right? She doesn't say Enrique's hot-tempered or upset about it or anything. And in fact, what does Sabrina do? She's texting Enrique about 12 hours later, hey, can we hang out tonight? So clearly, this idea that he's formed an intent to commit sexual assault, you don't have any evidence of that. How else can we know that the prosecution's, it's an educated guess, or I don't even know if it's educated. How is their guess? How do we know it's flawed? Well, the interior of Enrique's car was thoroughly processed. It's swabbed for DNA evidence several different times. They're applying these alternate light sources to it. They're looking in that thing like crazy. And what's the evidence that you have about what they discover from the interior of his car? Nothing. Nothing related to Christina Morris. And you remember my questions, Detective. Are you willing to just say that the fact that there's nothing related to Christina Morris, all these hairs you're finding in there aren't her, no DNA, no nothing. Are you willing to just tell me that that's some evidence, just some evidence that she was not in the passenger seat? No. They can't do it. They know that if they admit that to you, they got a big problem, but you don't need them to admit it to you for you to know the obvious truth. So let's talk about the DNA evidence in this case. And how do we get it? I take a lot for granted. I've been reading this file for, you know, a year and 9 months. And you're hearing it for the first time out of nowhere. And so I know it's hard to process it all, but here's the testimony. September 3rd, criminalist Bobble is processing Hunter Foster's car there at Plano PD. An hour later, she is inspecting and photographing Enrique's Camaro there at Plano PD. Well, you know Morris's DNA is in Hunter's car, and that's not much to ask you to believe. So the next day, September 4th, Bobel and Detective Stam are processing Morris's car at the Plano Police Department. A few hours later, they're processing Enrique, same criminalist, same garage. They're right there doing it. Now, they say, no, we're not wearing the hazmat suit or the Tyvek suit. We just have gloves on. We're not wearing booties. You know, yeah, everything was fine. But this is a one bay, one garage, and you've got all these cars coming in and out. And there's going to be some more in a minute where we'll talk about issues regarding transference. So soon after, we see that Morris's car is there, and then here's Enrique's car. And this doesn't, nobody needs to tell you this. This is how cross-contamination occurs. And what are we talking about in this case? You heard one of the state's witnesses describe for you the quantity, you remember that, of the DNA evidence? And do you remember I asked him, what are we talking about here? And he says, picograms. And a picogram is 1 trillionth of a gram. So what's a gram? A common household measurement, I asked him. A packet of sugar. So imagine opening a packet of sugar and pouring it out and divide it up into a trillion. Somehow divided up into trillion different parts. clearly you can't see it, right? We're talking about infinitesimal, hardly anything. Okay, this is the type of DNA that's being tested. And we know, we're going to get to it in a minute, that the DNA that they have, it's not blood. We know that. What about the Trump bat? You remember the testimony for that? It's put into a box, and the box isn't sealed. Ms. Wilson, she testified yesterday, the head of the CSI storage unit, she said an unsealed box left in the property room is a breach of protocol. That's not supposed to happen. What do we know? This box is put into the HON locker on September 29th. What else do we know is going on September 29th? Detective Sam's putting personal items of Christina Morris's into the same HON locker. Do you remember the photograph? All this is in evidence. You can see them. But they're photographs when they're processing Enrique's car, and they put a flashlight down there to get a view underneath the seat. Well, the testimony was that's how they process cars. So we've got tools that are being used in everybody's car, and the idea that we're going to transfer potentially just a trillionth of a gram becomes, it seems to be more in the realm of possibility, doesn't it? Talk about the damage to the Camaro. So the prosecution's second theory, it puts them in a real bind because they need that car to be undamaged when it's leaving the garage for this second theory to work. And they asked several different witnesses, did you notice? Was it damaged? Did you see anything? And most of these people said they weren't paying attention. One witness said that she didn't think so, but she couldn't be sure. All right, so obvious questions. Are any of these people inspecting the Camaro and paying attention to it? I mean, it's a fair question to ask. I get it. But there are other cars parked right next to the Camaro that would obstruct your view when you get out of whatever car you're getting out of. And think about their ability at that moment in time to perceive and remember events. They're back at Petroski's, drinking shots of 100-proof Captain Morgan rum. There's been evidence of tequila drinking. So I think it's a fair deduction to say that their powers of observation were less than optimal. What else do we know about this damage issue? Blake Sawyer, he's their video expert who analyzes video in the case. He testified that the area around the right fender well appeared to have a different reflective value than the other areas, of course indicating that the Camaro has damage to it when it's leaving the garage. And those are the photographs that I showed you either yesterday or Friday. You'll have them in evidence to look at in your deliberations. It's very clear that there is an issue going on in this area in terms of the reflection of the light, in that exact area where the prosecution says there's not damage. Have they proven to you beyond a reasonable doubt this issue of when the damage happens? Now, right, the theory's not working. We need the damage to be, we don't need it there in the garage under the second theory. So now Sawyer comes to the stand and he says, I can't tell. I tried, I just can't say either way. So in other words, they just can't prove it. They can't prove when this damage is happening. All right, so how else can you know that the damage to the Camaro and the injuries on Enrique's hand and arm happened before he went out to the shops at Legacy, before they go out? You remember Alex Buhider? I spelled it wrong. Alex Buhider, he testified to you, and he told you that before he went out that night, see, Enrique's texting or calling him, I think it was a phone call, I believe Alex testified to. He says, hey, I'm going to be out at the shops tonight. I know you live close by. Come join up. And Alex testified that in that conversation, Enrique is telling him he hurt himself. Detective Busby admits that if there was some evidence out there that he had injured himself before they went out that night, that would affect your theory. But you'll recall the way it was answered, if you had a witness. Well, thankfully she's under the rule. I guess she didn't know what Alex had testified to. We do have a witness who confirms that these injuries are before Enrique goes out. All right, so let's play along here. If the car is damaged somehow after it leaves the garage, then please tell us where that happens. Please tell us how. What proof do you have that the damage happened the way you say it did? Are you asking this jury to speculate? Do you remember this evidence? My preference is not to do a lot of objecting because you get it. You know what's going on. But do you remember, I think it was Officer Sasso saying, there's no way you could cause damage to the Camaro with your forearm or elbow. You just can't do it. But what did he tell you could cause it? A head. Please consider, are you being asked to base your decision on reason and common sense? Or is there an effort at all going on here to try to inflame you? So here's the bottom line. I mean, this is where we really are. As far as the cops know, he's the last person seen with her. So he just must have done something is the idea. But even under that, if you were to grant them that for the sake of argument, there's been no evidence of the what, when, where, or how. So they cobble this accusation together, and in support of it, they speculate and guess. We've spoken about this. Okay, so all the witnesses say no concerns about Enrique at all. No evidence to support this claim that there's an intent to commit sexual assault. And the last bit there goes without saying, doesn't it? If that's what makes an intent to commit sexual assault, then we're all in trouble. So let's talk about Hunter Foster. You remember Foster swore that he was testifying in this trial before you because the prosecution promised he wouldn't be prosecuted for anything related to Christina Morris. Foster claims he was at the Concrete Cowboy Bar at the W Hotel August 29th and 30th. You've had no evidence to confirm his whereabouts. None. He says that he saw Logan Prendergast at the Concrete Cowboy. Can't see it too well there. What did Logan testify to you? He wasn't there. He didn't even go to that bar. Foster claims he was with Taylor Berry and Ellen Etheridge on August 29th and 30th. Taylor Berry never came to court to testify to you. Ellen Etheridge never came to court to testify to you in corroboration of Hunter Foster. No banking records, no credit card records, nothing to help Foster in this claim of that he is where he says he is. What do you have? Cell data hits. You've heard the testimony about that today and the reliability of that in terms of saying a particular phone is at a particular place. So the next day, Hunter Foster's cell phone activity. There's no text activity from 3:55 a.m. until 4:54 p.m. At 3:55 a.m. is when Enrique and Christina are walking into the garage. There's no phone call activity on his phone, 4:58 a.m. until 4:41 p.m. Detective Stamp says she sees nothing odd in this. I understand these facts are unhelpful to their one of several theories, but these are the facts. So, yes, Plano police, they went out and interviewed him. Sure, you know, we talked to him. Are we really investigating him? Well, we know that on September 3rd, they're immediately sticking a tracking device on Enrique's car, like right out of the gates. They've already decided we got our guy. Well, Hunter's there on the same day. How about put a tracker device under his car? Let's see where he's going. You know, they did undercover surveillance, follow Enrique around. When he takes a sip of a soda, they take the can or the straw. There are no searches done by Plano in Tarrant County. He didn't call or text anyone about Christina. You remember that? He's getting calls from Christina's co-workers that Saturday. Where is she? She was supposed to come to work today. He's not responding. He's not answering. And he's not doing any of this. I think the evidence was until late on September 2nd, like around 11 p.m. It's the first time he reaches out to somebody and says, hey, got any news on Christina? The police admit to you, he is the most likely suspect in a missing person case. He's a boyfriend. You see, the thing about Hunter Foster is it requires no assumptions. Okay, Foster claims that he's at the Concrete Cowboy and the W Hotel on August 29th and 30th, and we know that that's not true. Pardon me. He says he was never outside the area of the uptown area in Dallas. But you know that's not true. The prosecutor gives you his North Texas toll authority records. He's in Addison and Plano. He testified to you, I never went north of 635 that day. Remember that? I never even went north of 635. Well, he's still not telling the truth about that. We know he was selling drugs to an undercover officer at Jaguars on August 29th. All right, so I'm sticking with this. An opening statement, I never promised you it was my mission to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt or otherwise, that Hunter Foster is directly responsible. Not my job to do it. I'm not trying to do it. What's the point I'm making? The prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he's not in some way. And not him necessarily. What about his connections? What about the people he owed drug money to? There are a lot of unanswered questions about that. According to LaTerrence Dunbar, this is the gentleman you heard from yesterday.
There's other facts outside the evidence. We'd ask you to remove from the screen.
Take it down, Mr. Cole. You argue outside the evidence again, it will be a problem.
Okay, well, I think the evidence was LaTerrence Dunbar said that his employment is that of providing personal security for individuals. He's talking to Christina for 30 minutes. Hunter walks up and her tone changes. It's very obvious that she just shuts down, was his testimony. So he didn't want to testify. He refused to do so without immunity until the U.S. Attorney's offices for these districts promised not to use his words against him for drug conspiracies. And the Collin County DA's office says that they also will not use his words against him for anything drug-related. Those were questions Mr. Fortenberry asked on his examination of Mr. Foster. Okay, but that's not the only reason he agreed to answer their questions. There's a quote, some of you I know have heard of it, that cross-examination is the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of truth. All right, and there, I had an exchange with Hunter Foster, I think, that was helpful. I asked him, you saw assurances from the DA's office that you would never be prosecuted for anything related to Christina Morris before you would agree to hit that stand. Isn't that true? And his answer? Okay. I don't know what's in Hunter Foster's mind, but it seems like in his mind he didn't want to get up there unless he was promised. Okay. What did the prosecutor, the official agreement, we're not going to prosecute you for drug offenses? Well, ask yourself this question. If Hunter Foster is completely excluded, just completely, why not give him what he thinks he's got anyway? Why not give him immunity for anything related to Christina Morris? He's not a suspect. But they're not about to do that. They're not about to offer him immunity for anything related to this. All right, so here's some points to consider I think that would be helpful. The prosecution wants you to think that anytime Enrique misspeaks or misremembers or says something that isn't 100% accurate, that that's evidence that he's guilty as charged in the indictment. Okay, but the state's witnesses, are they held to that same standard? Okay, all of the partygoers, they forgot or confused events of that evening. It's obvious why. But none of them could remember exactly how much they drank. Some of them couldn't remember which bar they went to first. Some couldn't remember, you remember this? Some of them could not remember which parking garage they parked in, just like Enrique. Some didn't remember who was in Sabrina Boss's car when she dropped off Justin Hill and Bree Lofton and James. And do you remember, there were a couple of witnesses that couldn't remember if there were five or six. Somebody said that they sat in the very back where there's not a seat. Other people said nobody was back there. Okay, obviously they're not all liars. Of course not. They had been partying, and it's been 2 years, and they get mixed up. They're human. But when Enrique does it, it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he did the words in the indictment. So, is this type of double standard fair? I'm not asking that Enrique you not evaluate the statements he gave. Of course you'll do that. That's completely appropriate. But they're holding him to a standard that, and they ask you to hold the other witnesses to a different standard. So Enrique gets a call from Detective Sam on September 3rd. He's at work. You heard the conversation. And he gets her number and he says, give me the address and I'll meet you there. And sure enough, he gets off work and he goes. And when he gets there, he says, yeah, you can look at my car. I'll sign the voluntary consent form. The form that tells me you're going to look at my trunk. The form that tells me anything in here can be used against me. He has no problem with it at all. He answers all their questions. He didn't ask for a lawyer. He didn't have to talk to them. And he lets them photograph his body, not just his arms and hands, which he's wearing a short-sleeved shirt. So it's not like he was trying to hide the obvious injuries he had. And then they say, well, pull your shirt up and turn around and do all that. I'm speculating they thought this would be a big reveal and you're going to see some big evidence, and there's not. So he goes again the second time on September 3rd. They call him, come back in. We got more questions for you. This is when they put on the tracking device. And at that time, they had their suspect. They had it. They said on September 4th, he's been twice on the 3rd, and now he's going back for the third time on September 4th. He again allows them to photograph his car, and now they're processing it. They could have processed it the day before. They say we didn't have somebody there to do it, but it's not like Enrique was trying to prevent it. They again ask him questions, and he answers. He's wearing short sleeves again. Okay, so let's move on. You remember the prosecutor told you that there are three main things to consider in this case. You're supposed to look at the evidence in light of these three factors: video, DNA, and cell phone evidence. So let's take a look at the cell phone evidence. This is one of their three pillars. Okay, the prosecution's witness in this regard is Detective Vinzi. Okay, here's the question. He's an eminently likable officer. There's no question about it. But in August of 2014, he's on neighborhood patrol. He's a foot officer. Somebody drinks too much, they get arrested for public intoxication. Steal a handbag from Kate Spade, he'll take you in. And now he makes detective in January of 2015, and he's become an expert in cell phone tower analysis. Hey, but you heard the testimony today from Robert Aguero. And you heard all the map, you saw the maps that were introduced, and Mr. Benzig says, I agree, those maps are fine, I've got no issue with those. But what Benzig was asking you to do was, hey, these are cell tower data hits, and we know that means that the car's within 3 miles of there. And that clearly is not the right explanation for cell tower data usage. It'd be one thing if these were text messages we're talking about, or phone calls, but we're not. And so either Detective Benzig, on his examination when he's answering questions from the prosecutor, he either doesn't know that or he didn't want to do a full explanation of it. All right, so either way, you're being asked to trust his analysis. And in light of Mr. Aguero's testimony, I think it's clear that this data hits whatever you... I think it's clear that type of evidence is unreliable. Detective Sam and Detective Busby both agree if the analysis isn't right, then that's a problem. And this entire theory that Enrique's car, we know it gets on the toll road, it exits at the Custer Road gantry. Okay, we know that. What it does after that is a complete guess on their part. What they want to say is we have cell tower data hits around 4:50 a.m., 4:27 a.m., and that means that his car is back in this area. The evidence has not shown that at all. They're not entitled in any way to that kind of assumption. I mean, you saw it. There are three-minute spans at around 3 in the evening or 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, and Enrique's getting cell tower data hits 80 miles away towards Fort Worth, 50-something miles away. These data hits are all over the place because it's Sprint network doing internal processing. It's not a phone use event such that you can decide where somebody is. And along these lines, doesn't it make sense that Enrique, why would he go to his neighbor and say, hey, I know you got a camera there by my garage. Would you mind checking it out at 4:30? Because the police are really on me now, and I'd love to show him since I know you have a camera. Okay, one, he wouldn't ask that if he wasn't home at 4:30. That's ridiculous. And how long does it take to get if you leave at about 3:58 a.m. back to Allen? I don't know, 20 to 30 minutes? Just depends. They're asking you to trust Benzik's analysis beyond a reasonable doubt. And imagine if you had not heard from Mr. Aguero today how you might view the cell phone data, records, and analysis. Did the police officers strike you as objective fact collectors? Or based on their answers, did it appear at times that they had an agenda, that they have a preferred outcome here? They can do that, but it seems to me that would call into question their motives in the investigation. Do you hear Detective Sam on Friday? She says it. Oh, maybe the injuries were a bite mark. If she knew in October 2014 that Dr. Paula Brummett told her unequivocally it's not, and yet they're still saying it. Hey, they know there's not blood evidence in the trunk, but they won't admit it. What the criminalists, Susan Hassan, and you remember the James Bond guy, Neil Carnes? What do they both swear to you? If it's a blue star reaction that's faint, it's not blood. Do you remember that Carnes said he had never seen a less impressive blue star reaction, the faintest he had ever seen? What's that telling you? Well, it's some evidence. They won't even acknowledge it, that it's not blood. But then it goes off to the lab, and what's the lab say? Not blood. I bet you anything in a minute you're going to hear them argue that it was. Okay, Erica Scott, the head of the CSI unit, she testified about the blue star reacting, confirming everything that you've already heard, that it was faint. If it's faint, it's not blood. All right, so the official certified labs that conduct blood testing in this case, they tell you it's not. Why are we having this argument? All right, you remember Detective Garcia, he says he places a tracker under Enrique's car. And it's the cleanest thing he's ever seen. It's like coming off the showroom. So I asked him, if a witness comes in and says we found debris and plants underneath there, then we'll know it happened after you inspected it. And what does he say? Oh, no, no, no. I only looked under a couple of areas of the car. Oh. Hey, Benzik, he didn't collect any videotape past, I think his testimony was 7 to 8 a.m. on August 30th. Just stopped. We just don't need any more of that video. No video anywhere. Maybe there's no video of the Camaro coming back to the shops at Legacy under their theory. Just maybe there's no video of that because the Camaro didn't come back. And you're asked to take his word for it, just like you were asked his whole video analysis. You're supposed to take his word for it just like you are on cell phone data. He even admits you can get out of that garage on foot without being seen on a camera. These just seem like obvious points to me. Maybe there wasn't an event in the car. We have no evidence that there was. Nothing about the interior of the car indicates any kind of struggle. No rips or tears, no footprints on the windshield, nothing. All right, then there's this whole business about, well, he filled up with 7 gallons, and a few days later, he got some more gallons. This is where we're at. He's guilty because he's pumping up a couple of times. And it's not the normal routine. This is the quality of evidence they're asking you to base your verdict on. All right, Morris texts, Hunter, I'm going to take a taxi home. Benzik says there were taxis and cars for hire in the area at 4 a.m. There was even a green Kia Soul in the area circling around. If you're using an Uber app, hey, we're not going to see that on your phone records. And you know from common experience, Uber drive right up to your feet. Benzik just couldn't identify the driver of that car. Okay, so here's just briefly on this Collin County thing. Let's assume for the sake of argument, let's just assume you think something happened, that in some way you think it's a kidnapping. Hey, they haven't even proven Collin County. That's why the judge is giving you this instruction. All they say is that this data usage event is near the Granite Parkway. Officer Sasso says 2.9 miles to the west, Denton County. And even Sasso and Stan admit it. They don't know when or where or what. But if you want to play along with them, they admit they can't prove where. That they all say it. We don't know. I can't have been the one that pointed this issue out. There's no way that I'm the one who alerted them to this problem in their case. So can the police and prosecutors really be wrong in a case like this? Do you remember juror number 80 in jury selection, Mrs. Boyle? Her mother was abducted and she was murdered.
Facts outside the record.
Sustained.
We ask you to remove the slide.
Sustained.
Your Honor, I just, by the way,
take it down.
Okay, I need to pass through here. Okay, how do wrongful convictions happen? In circumstantial evidence cases just like this, when juries are being asked to base decisions on less than proof beyond a reasonable doubt, okay, presumption of innocence. The law has already signed the verdict form for you. The only way that it changes is if you erase it. That's if you find the words have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And we saw this. So what's clear and convincing evidence? It's the kind of evidence that gives you a firm conviction or belief in the issue to be proved. You believe a firm conviction and belief. Beyond a reasonable doubt is more than that. What more than that is it? That's up to you. But this is not supposed to be an easy process. This is not supposed to be something where you just issue out a guilty verdict. The law intends for this to be hard for you. Okay, who do these rights protect? Presumption of innocence, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, they obviously, Enrique. Okay, but they protect you. Do you understand what they're asking you to do? Something that they don't have the power to do? And the law says before we're going to put our citizens in a position to make these kinds of decisions, we're not going to ask you to do it unless the evidence is so convincing beyond a reasonable doubt. You don't want to have to worry about, am I doing the right thing? You don't want to think about every time you hear on the news a story, does this call into question what you've done here? There it is. It's what I always said. The judge just read it to you, as charged in the indictment. Okay, so here's what the drill sergeant is telling you. They have to prove each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay, this is a photo. You all taught me something in jury selection because I looked at that picture and I thought number two's the winner. And some hands went up and said not so fast. And I really appreciated that because I had my blinders on. I thought this picture perfectly illustrated the point I wanted to make. And thank you for teaching me that lesson. I hope that that's the type of analysis that you will bring to the state's evidence. Because they want you to, this is representative of their case, isn't it? See, there it is. We got evidence. See, right there. Well, hold on now. Hold on now. Prove to us. Prove it. Okay, and here we go. Okay, if you look here on the left, just, I'm going to suggest to you that that's Plano Police Department. Yes, Your Honor. They see four, and let's just say you can understand their perspective. The problem is they refuse to even see the possibility that it's something else. I asked Detective Busby, you have an unfalsifiable theory. There's nothing I can do or say that's going to change your theory. And that's where we're at. So I'd ask you to please stand the wall, guard it, really look at what the judge is asking you to do, the instructions that you've been given, and analyze it. Please look at all of this. I'm not afraid of an inch of this. The evidence is not there beyond a reasonable doubt, and I would ask for your verdict of not guilty. Thank you.
Enrique would be found guilty of the aggravated kidnapping of Christina Morris. He was sentenced to life in prison. Enrique remained stone-faced, but at one point, he smirked when Christina's father was giving his victim impact statement. His attorneys appealed on the grounds that there was not enough evidence to convict, that there should have been a change of venue due to the publicity of the case, and that the warrants used by the detectives were defective. His appeal is pending review. The Morris family and Team Christina continue their fight to find her. I wanted to reach out to those who knew her. I didn't want to read a blurb from an internet article or a newspaper about how she was. I wanted to hear it from someone who knew her. So I asked the moderator of the Help Find Christina Facebook group to give me a description of her personality and demeanor. Here's what they said. She is energetic, spunky, happy, optimistic, and goal-oriented. She loves all kinds of music, animals, especially giraffes, fashion, and loves meeting and getting to know new people. She's the type of person that 5 minutes into your first conversation, you feel like you've known her your whole life. She loves lifting people up around her and encouraging them to work toward their dream. She's creative and spontaneous and silly and has a zest for life. She's truly undefinable and is a one-of-a-kind, amazing person. Christina Morris was last seen entering a parking garage with an acquaintance at the Shops at Legacy in Plano, Texas, on August 30th, 2014. That acquaintance, Enrique Arochi, is now serving a life sentence in prison for the aggravated kidnapping of Christina. She has still not been found. If you have any information regarding the disappearance or current whereabouts of Christina Morris, contact Plano Police at 972-424-5678 or leave an anonymous tip with the Crime Stoppers at 877-373-TIPS. A $30,000 reward is offered. You can find more information and more ways to help on the Help Find Christina Facebook page. If you live in the Collin County area and would like to aid in the search for Christina, please go to the Facebook page, go to events, and click Going. They need all the help they can get. I would like to give special thanks to Team Christina for their assistance in understanding who Christina was as a person. My hope with this episode was to utilize my platform to get her name out there and to bring further attention to her case. Someone knows something, and I hope that Christina is able to be brought home soon. Until next time. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. It really helps us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com.